When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Again with your
being
yeah so you know that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air and it's like therapy, you know. If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You know, tell your whole podcast.
Yeah, so who are we talking about today, Matt?
Straight out from that southeast end of Cuba, as Columbus did on the 6th of December, 1492, and breast the intervening 50 miles of foaming, rushing blue water with its flying fish and screaming seabirds, you will come next to the second largest island of the romantic archipelago, an island wholly in the tropics.
Oh shit, let me call Mike. We gotta start this podcast up soon.
It is a cluster of steep mountain tops arising from broad faces on the ocean floor to make a heavily broken patch of terra firma. When Columbus saw this particular island, he called it Hispaniola, the Spanish. But the million or so Arawak Indians who were there before him already had a name for it. They called it Haiti, Land of Mountain. The name still varies, for today it comprises no less than two of the republics of the Western Hemisphere. The Dominican Republic occupies perhaps two-thirds of the area, the other, the Republic of Haiti, on the western third of the island, and Port-au-Prince being on an important air route between North and South America. In Columbus's day, the Indians thought that he came out of the sky in ships that really were great birds. The Spaniards were amused. But today, strangers from afar actually do descend on IT from the sky.
Mike Juan and Mark the Mystic write down handbooks, apocalyptic rivers, Susquehanna, alchemistic, deliver patterns, synchronistic, catch you up if you miss this. So let's kick this Columbus Chris shit. Drop the parabolic, the hyperbolic, it's all symbolic, a Catholic, diabolic amongst the Spanish who sailed across the Atlantic. Navigation, astro-oceanic, compass mechanics, hit land, the natives panic, thought Chris was messianic. From the other side of the planet, how could they plan it? Evil antics become truly satanic. Greedy ultramanic, raped indigenous, become Hispanic. Hispaniola was planted, supplanted natives, enslaved and arranged on plantations under flags of foreign nations. Convert for your salvation, face the death of your civilization. In God's name, abomination. Replaced and ravaged them, denigrated them as savages. Only value today in batting averages and baseball practices. Escape hell, become Americans, how disparaging. It's all a dream, it's all a scheme, it's all an American scheme, it's all a fucking American dream, it's all a dream, it's all a scheme, it's an American scheme, a fucking American dream, it's all a dream, it's all a scheme, an American scheme, it's all a fucking American dream. Theosophical baseball teams chronicle alien schemes, delete blood streams, prophesize in biblical scenes.
I've seen it.
It's all a dream.
I've seen it.
It's all a fucking American dream. It's all a dream. It's all a scheme. 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 American's dream is America's schemes.
I've seen it.
It's all a fucking dream.
I've seen it. So that is, you know, the word Haiti. Haiti is phonetically the same. It's a French word, but it's phonetically the same as Hades. In fact, in Dominican Spanish, they'll drop the S. Like, that's just a known fact of how Dominican Spanish, the other part of Hispaniola, other than Haiti, they drop the S in their enunciation of most words that end with S, so they would call Hades Haiti anyway. Like, Haiti is the underworld. It's both a symbol of life and death. And so understanding that paradigm is held in place through esoteric ritual, and almost all of them are some type of life-death ritual. Like, that's the dance which they're trying to manage. Like, going to Haiti or going to this island and maybe recognizing its role esoterically, like, for the listener, what it does is it begins to collapse some of the false narrative stories. And anytime they collapse, just like a subliminal advertisement, which you see the subliminal and you're like, oh, it no longer has its effect upon me because I've seen it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back with possibly one of my favorite guests of all time. He's been a guest on this show so frequently that him and I started our own podcast that I would venture to guess most new listeners have no flipping clue about. It's on wherever you're listening to this podcast, so you don't have to go out of your way. But you probably better know this guest from his own work that he's done on huge podcasts and his modest YouTube channel, which needs your love and support. So please, folks, go and check out the full video linked in the episode description. And that, of course, is the Susquehanna Alchemy YouTube channel and the Susquehanna Alchemist himself, my good friend. Uncle Mike is back on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast / Your Hand for the Apocalypse for all of our OG real ones out there who have been listening since day one. But like I said, most of the new people might not know that Mike and I do a show together. So this is a little bit of both. You're getting a little taste of both. Your Handbook for the Apocalypse, Susquehanna Alchemy, and My Family Thinks I'm Crazy all rolled into one. So since I've got all that off my chest, Mike, you just returned from a beautiful adventure. Before we get into all of that, how are you? It's been way too long since we've hit the mic together.
Brother, it's been a really long time, and it's good to be back. And the reason it's been such a long time is because life has just been so moving so fast for me. And so because of that, a lot of the regular outlets which I would appear on, whether that was Your Handbook for the Apocalypse or maybe my own content and other shows which I was regular on, or even just being like one-time guests, it just almost all came to a stop. It's been slowing down. So it wasn't, and that wasn't necessarily a plan. It was like a circumstance of life. But where I'm going with this is that introduction that you gave. Well, first off, it's been a while since I've been on the show, and I don't think I've ever heard an introduction quite like that. And it's phenomenal. Thank you. But it got me thinking about this whole idea of the body of work which we've recorded. And specifically this idea of Your Handbook for the Apocalypse, which was more or less just mine and yours discussion of life, like conceptually, like what we think is going on, what the experience of being alive and in this realm is. And, you know, that coupled with the fact that there is a seeming evidential like mass change in how life is lived on Earth is happening in this general time period. And so the podcast, Your Handbook for the Apocalypse, was this real off-the-cuff sort of place for you and I to discuss like life in theory during a time like this, and then also share the specifics, maybe primarily with a lot of the adventures within my life of, you know, what these concepts look like in practice. So all that said, I just told you the last couple of months for me have just been like my life, which has already been, you know, from some people's perspective, off the rails for the past 4 years. Like it just went into this free fall. And I've been asking myself, and particularly with your introduction, and I'm like, you know, what is it, the chicken or the egg? Did us talking about all of this, like, you know, the handbook for the apocalypse, did that bring about that in lifestyle, like a personal apocalypse, if you will? Because I would say that might be a fair way of describing what the life circumstances have been. Or was that just like kind of like we were just like spot on, like with our instincts? You're like, okay, the ride's just going to get bumpier and bumpier. And the beauty of it is there's a continuity. Like listening to the earlier episodes, we can kind of hear this continuity of like life is going to get apocalyptic, whether that's metaphorical or literal, and then approach of what it would be, and then actually seeing or listening to the story of it unfolding in the real time of our recording. So I think that's one of the most enjoyable things about what you and I are doing here. And it serves for me an opportunity to kind of put into context these stories I'm going to tell, we're going to talk about. But yeah, I'm grateful to be here. I'm doing well, but I don't think it's just me who has been experiencing like major shifting in all ways of life right now, but you know, I'm still here. And I am really pleased to go over some of the stories we're going to talk about from this adventure, which I just returned home from.
Yeah, it is something that I have thought about too, Mike. You know, I really admire your courage and bravery and transparency to just kind of share what you do about your life. I think even what you share is, you know, bold and brave and inspiring for a lot of people. But yeah, it is funny. You mentioned the reflecting on the title of your handbook for the apocalypse, because, you know, it is that chicken or the egg kind of conundrum you find yourself in. And I try not to play the blame game in that sense, but oftentimes there is that thought that I get, and I don't know if this is just me and my own insecurities, but I do sometimes think to myself, like in almost like a superstitious way, like, oh, I shouldn't say that about my future. I shouldn't say that about my, you know, et cetera. So saying, oh, hey, we're going to create a handbook for the apocalypse for you guys in the form of an audio podcast that, you know, exists seemingly forever on the internet. Yeah, I mean, the energetic charge from that has certainly, we witnessed it. And maybe, yeah, that was like a type of intuition.
Can I jump in for a second?
Almost like hearing the train horn as it rushes past us. But yeah, please jump in.
So apocalypse means like the time between two ages, quote unquote, however you want to define ages. And probably the most grounded way, it's in ways which people lived. You know, that would be a different age when it's so drastic that people are living differently than the previous time. And we're experiencing that. That's like literally happening. And like, I want to be clear with at least the posture which I hold with it is like, without getting into woo, let's say, it's crystal clear from anyone who is born, if they look at their life, the unfolding of culture during their lifetime. So if assuming you're born sometime after 1945, there is a very evident movement in technology where you could go and see, and we're born into it. And where that movement was going, like it was always going towards the internet. That was or and wherever the internet is going to be going. So when I talk about apocalypse, like a lot of it is grounded in the level of like technology and that changing life. But then it's grounded more deeply and also like the mystery of like something else is changing, or there's an opportunity within this opportunity of time to bring a certain level of awareness, and the change of life could be something much more different than what has been laid out before us from a technological or paradigm level. Meaning like the entire the potentiality for how life in general in this mystery is being experienced, like it's going to change. And when we talk about apocalypse, or when I use that phrase, it's a recognition of that's happening right now. Like, you know, at least in the stories they tell us, like apocalyptic events have occurred in the past, and this is something major. And we've been born into it. It's not like something that just happened. Like, you know, I don't necessarily put a lot of weight into like, you've chosen to be here, your soul chose to be here. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But like, let's just kind of, what we can say is like, you're here and it's extraordinary. It may be uncomfortable at times, but it's like perspective is like, this is where we are. Like there's no like judgment in terms of like, I wish it would have been a different time or anything like that. Like now this is it. And so there's a great degree of everything from like an immense amount of respect we should hold for this time. I like the fact that you use the word courage, because I think it requires a lot of that, because everything is collapsing. And everything is collapsing because it's changing into something else. That is what the apocalypse is. And then to see it and know what to do. Because the easy thing is to go along with it, because the thing which is comfortable in the past has gone away. And the courage is stepping into something you don't quite know what it is. And there being fear there. I mean, it's healthy. You know, it serves one to have fear. It's a little bit probably, it doesn't serve someone to lack a fear response. But the courage is like what it requires to still step forward despite any sort of fears. And I think the biggest part of that is really like a sense of humor, or a sense of like romanticism with it. Like, you know, this is a grand story. This is literally happening. And how much we're like, as I'm talking about this more, like, you know, I started it with the question, like, you know, the chicken and the egg. I mean, maybe I just say that because it's poetic sounding, but as I hear myself, the words come out of my mouth, it's like there really isn't any part within me which is denying the fact that this is what, you know, this is the reason why we're here, to live through this time and then specifically to move through each person's personal apocalypse, because two things are going to happen is as culture change, culture is just it's a mass created paradigm, and it's false. We talk about that all the time, but that mass created paradigm is held up by the false sense of all of the individuals who make up the masses. So like there's a false sense in the individual who holds up the paradigm, and who the human being is when they interact with the paradigm, or when they bump up or integrate with it, is like, you know, what they would call a false self. So the apocalypse means two things. You don't just have one collapse, you have to have two collapses. And so that's really where it becomes interesting, and like outer events are really just reflections of inner events, or inner events are reflections of the outer events, because they're linked, and both of these things are collapsing. And as they're collapsing, you know, there's like everything that comes with the collapse, both personally and culturally. And then there's the what is presenting itself after the collapse. And what we're doing here, I think, with sharing personal stories, or at least what I'm hoping it's doing, you know, as the handbook for the apocalypse, it's not so much like this is how you do it, but more so is like, this is kind of what it looks like. Like, this is one example of what it looks like, so that when you see the parallels within your own life, both in terms of collapse, but then also in terms of like what is presenting itself and new, it's like you begin to recognize it. You begin to recognize it as a more universal archetype for going through this process. And so I've said this in so many of our episodes in the past. It's like this is a like an observer created experiment, what we're doing as well. The audience, by listening, like, they become involved both ways. Like, you know, it gives us, you and me, a witness for what we're discussing, but two, the ideas which are being discussed then work their way back into the individual's own like inner world. And these ideas which we're discussing meets them in their actual experience, and they begin to have a general model. It's like, okay, this is what's happening. And why that's helpful is like when you're in that, like the wilderness, and there's no trail because you're the trailblazer in your own life. If you can get any sort of like insight, like it's always helpful and beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that kind of sparks a thought in me. I don't want to spend too much time on what I'm about to bring up, because I know you recently posted on your YouTube channel a video breakdown of your adventure, and I definitely want to wade through that and have you tell us some of the insights. But have you ever heard of a game played online? It's been around for quite a while. It's evolved a bit, but have you ever heard of this game called GeoGuessr?
No.
So what's fun about GeoGuessr, and you might like this, maybe you won't like this, I don't know. I'm curious to hear your take on this, Mike. But what GeoGuessr does is it randomly puts you somewhere on the map, and you can choose world or United States or whatever country you want, but they'll send you anywhere randomly, right? And all you have is the Google Street View to figure out where you are, and they give you a map of the entire world, and you take your little cursor and you do your best to guess as accurately as you can what part of the world you're currently looking at from your Google Street View. And you can move around a little bit. You can't, you know, it's you're limited to just kind of moving with the Google Street View mechanics. You can only go so far. But I played a little bit last night, and it was a lot of fun to be like a detective and try to figure out, you know, oh, geez, what country am I in? And, you know, we'll look around and see, oh, there's a little sign there. Oh, what language is that? Okay, I could narrow it down a little bit. But even when you get the language right, you're like, oh, shoot, which country is it? But yeah, it was a lot of fun. And you just kind of reminded me of that when you said that, you know, being out blazing your own trail in life, and you have to take whatever hints and clues you can get. So why not open yourself up to this other awareness that we all have? It's just our society teaches us to neglect it because we're so consciousness forward. We're so, you know, super conscious forward. We don't think about the subconscious or really how we can work with it. We mostly just think about our conscious and our super conscious, you know, our ability to pray and our connection with higher powers, and then what we can do in our own mind. But yeah, it's, I don't know, maybe the geo-guessing thing is a little bit of a tangent, but you just reminded me of that.
I'd like to respond to that.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, so geo-guessing. So first off, one, my oldest son made reference like a week before I left on the trip that he was just doing that. And I forget exactly why I think it was like a place which he guessed was maybe where I was going. But I'd never heard of it prior to him mentioning that 3 weeks ago. So it's funny you bring it up again. I already have an idea of what it is. And on a certain level, like that would hit me in my dopamine addiction center. that would be so much fun for me. What's happening with that is there's multiple things that is happening. It's undoubtedly developing the part of consciousness which we think of as remote viewing.
Huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you know how remote viewing works and how all the projects project, like the supposed Project Stargate things worked, like they would do things like that. It wouldn't be as rich as an experience. It was more remote viewing than just like how a Project Stargate remote viewer would be guided through the process. But it's almost like remote viewing on training wheels on a certain level. But so from the user who is doing that, two things, like the more you use your logical mind, like, can I logically figure that out? You're not really getting into the remote viewing consciousness state. And the more that it becomes intuitive or inner knowing, that part of the consciousness is being invoked. What it's probably training well to do is to even link those two, I suppose.
That's really
fascinating. You can look at it that way, but that's what's happening. But
I intuitively, just to quickly jump off of what you said, I intuitively guessed a few of them, one of them down to yards, which typically you get within miles, but one of my guesses was down to the yards. So I was like, whoa, you know, but yeah.
So exactly. Like, I mean, it would make sense. You would be really good at it. It would make sense. Probably anyone who listens to the show would be good at that. So there's a way where you can say that this is a training tool and you could use it as a fun training tool, stuff like that. But then also you know, you're doing it on the internet. You're doing it on a Google platform. You're doing it on a machine potentially, which is like, you know, reading everything about you. And it is, at least that capability is there to be able to, whatever the metrics which the computer in front of the person is doing, it's picking up those readings. Like, you know, Facebook can tell you the person's mood based upon like 150 different things going on in the face. Imagine what top secret technology of what it can read from the user would do. And so then you'll be like, well, what would be the purpose of that? And it could be anything from like, you know, military, like learning or machine learning, or it could be somehow it's set up in such a way, like a Ender's Game sort of scenario where it's being used to like do, you know, that remote viewing is actually being meta combined with everyone else's information and something else entirely, which none of the participants realize that they're participating in. I mean, there's just like a whole bunch of potentiality of what's happening with someone who's going into that state over these platforms. So, and that's why it's so addictive. Like, you know, it's all of these games, you know, if you're not paying for it, it's because you're the product. I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah, absolutely right. And great.
And a person would need to make it's not my job to tell anyone how to live. The only thing which I would suggest is to, you know, be totally aware of what you're doing. Like, yeah, if I don't give a shit about it, then don't give a shit.
Yeah, good point. It is kind of a little bit concerning to think they might be using that game to, like, I don't know, inform drones and other technologies that would need to be able to quickly geo-position and figure out where they are if their GPS system goes off or something like that.
Everything in the society which is technologically based, even the stuff which isn't technologically based, is construed. If it's paradigm based, it's construed for a purpose which is completely different than what anyone thinks it is, whether that's going to a baseball game, whether that's voting in an election, whether that's playing any of the countless of free games that are on everyone's smartphones. Like you're a human resource in the paradigm. And everything, and the paradigm is based upon economics, getting the most bang for your buck. So like every single thing which of value, which can be milked out of your divinely given creativity and consciousness, like, yeah, they're taking it. So it's not just this, like, you know, don't be paranoid about that. It's like, that's, That's everything. You and I are recording on computers right now. Go to the internet. Same thing's happening.
Yeah.
But we can use it, just like have awareness and be honest.
Absolutely right. Well, and I think going back to what we were saying before, I mentioned geoguessing. What we're going to talk about today is an example of how people can leave those ties that bind you to your computer and get out and explore the world. Of course, you know, not to the T of Mike's adventure, right? You know, find your own path. But yeah, by example, I think we can learn a lot. And I already feel like you're trying to segue us into that with your baseball reference. It is baseball season and it's heating up, right? Obviously, the baseball season's in full swing now, no pun intended. You don't strike me as much of a sports fan, though, Mike. Maybe when you were younger, but I sort of get the sense that you're not much of a sports fan. I know you've talked about tennis in the past, but that's more of Emily's interest, your friend Emily Moyer. But as far as sports go, is baseball a big one for you, or are you just not? Is my reading on you correct that you're not really, you don't follow much sports?
All right. I'll go with you down this line.
Oh, great.
One is I have a great appreciation and love of athleticism and sports. I'm not a fan of any sport, but I'll watch. I love to watch any human interaction in excellence form. Like, I love to watch sports. I'm not a fan. I don't like have teams. I just like to see what the human being and the drama of competition. It's enjoyable right for me. Yeah.
You like sport as a concept. You're not like you don't identify as a fan nor a fan of any particular team. That's really what I meant, is like, I don't get the sense that you're the average American sports fan. I've never heard you talk about the you know, Packers kicked ass last night, or the Eagles, or what, you know. I've never heard that from you, and that's something I don't talk about either. But yeah, I don't know, baseball feels in my mind like, even though I'm not a big fan of it, it's one of those sports that I can watch, I guess is my point, and still kind of enjoy it. Still sort of feel like there's something American about it. And maybe that's just my upbringing and being exposed to baseball so much. But yeah, there's something for me that baseball transcends just the exhibition of human athleticism.
All right. So I'm pausing on how I want to respond to this. So I guess this is the segue. So I've talked a lot about baseball as it relates to the Susquehanna mystery in the past. And the reason is because the Susquehanna River is the baseball river. And I say that because at the source is where the Baseball Hall of Fame is located. And then at the peak of the West Branch is where the Little League World Series is played and Little League was established, Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And, you know, there's a long history of that. Perhaps you and I have talked about on this program before. But so let's, like, a big jump then would be the trip which you're just referring to. I just returned back from a 14-day stay in the Dominican Republic. And, like, I wouldn't call it a vacation. And I mean, I think you were being silly that when you said that you've never heard me talk about, like, a sports team, all the, you know, the Eagles. Like, I would imagine that would be, like, self-evident. Like, the whole purpose of what we talk about and how I try to live my life is not putting of being very, very conscious of what and how I put where I'm putting my consciousness in interaction with paradigms. So, like, to think that I would have that relationship with any of the sports, that doesn't make sense, or anything, to be angry about anything of paradigm. It's paradigm. I'm not going to let that suck that type of energy from me. But I'm immensely interested in studying paradigm. And so I put a lot of intellectual curiosity into it, as opposed to emotional currency into it. And on this trip to the Dominican Republic, which was not a vacation, and it wasn't something like I purposely went out to do. Like, I came with someone else and I didn't really want to go But that being said, I respect the fact that my life brought me here, and I trust the unfolding of life greater than, you know, my plans for what I think my life should be. And then I would apply the hindsight. I would ask the question, like, well, why Dominican Republic? Why was I here? You know, what was the significance? And this is, I think, a helpful technique each person should do within their life is, like, you know, all you can do is study your own life. So it's like wherever, however life brings you, like, why am I here? One of the neat things about seeing your game scene is you can be a little bit more proactive about where you're going to go to. But if you're just completely observing the unfolding of your life based upon, like, you know, the things and the people who are involved in your life, you go and whatever comes, whether enjoyable or not enjoyable, with like a curiosity of exploration, of understanding it more deeply, and then being able to maybe see a larger trajectory. So that being said, I go to the Dominican Republic and I'm asking, well, why am I here? Why am I having such an intense internal experience? Like, it was really, really challenging. And one of the things that became really evident after that question is that the island of the Dominican Republic, so the Dominican Republic is on an island. The other half of the island is Haiti, and that island is called Hispaniola. And that island is it's where the first colony of the age of navigation. It's like where Christopher Columbus set up the first colony, you know, based upon the indoctrinated history, which everyone gives us. That island is the first. It predates the establishment of the first colony of the British Empire on the Susquehanna by 115 years. But the British Empire is an extension of what started in Hispaniola. So the first started in Hispaniola, and there are a bunch of colonies from a bunch of countries all in the New World. This is the story they tell us. And then of all of these different vying factors, the winner, you know, the quote unquote winner of the takeover was the British Empire. So really their colony is the one that matters. Like, no one cares about like the Dutch's first colony, Holland. Is that what it is? Their first colony in the New World, or France's first colony, because what really matters is like who came out on top. So there's a link there. There's a link told through the telling of history, and where history has its first fruit woven onto the physical landscape. Whether it happened or not is almost irrelevant. And that being the mouth of the Susquehanna Bay or the Chesapeake Bay and this island of Hispaniola. So then I saw there's a link there. This is a link in like the language which I use to understand reality. And I'm like, okay, this is starting to make more sense. And so I dug deeper and deeper. And one of the outer expressions, and it's just a demonstration, if you will, an outer expression is that the Susquehanna River is also the baseball river. Without getting into, you know, what is baseball, it is endowed energetically from the very beginning of the flow from both of its sides with baseball. And if this area, once it leaves, if the current or the energy, once it leaves the Susquehanna body of water out through the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, where the first landing occurred, it then flows all the way down to Hispaniola. And then you're like, okay, well, what do we know about baseball in Hispaniola? Well, if you actually go and you look at the major league, proportionately speaking, if the major league is the United States Professional Baseball League is the symbol of the greatest or the most elite baseball players, you got to be like really good to play in the major leagues. There is a higher proportionate to population. The proportion from player to population in the major leagues is greater from Hispaniola than anywhere else on earth. And not by a little bit, but by a like like fivefold or tenfold. And so like the baseball thing, which we're talking about, and I literally recorded a video about this an hour before you and I are doing this show right now, is like looking more deeply into like, okay, we see that there's a connection between the Susquehanna and Hispaniola. And now we see there's a connection between baseball and Hispaniola. Then the question is like, well, what is baseball, you know, and going into its theosophical connection and its fertility rights connection. And, you know, this whole other story unfolded. And so without getting into all those details, and to correct you, I did not make a video explaining all of this. I made a video so far that I've released, which only explains the opening chapter. This is like such a big concept that I need probably four or five different videos to really cover the entire gamut of what I want to share. The thing which is interesting is, you know, this collapses the idea of paradigm, because this is a story that does not fit with paradigm logic. So there's a collapse right there. And then there's a collapse which I have personally, because I lived this experience, and I, as I indicated, I had like an intense time while there, like there was something collapsing in me. And so witnessing this, you know, this is, all of this is immensely personal, like internal. It's immensely personal that it lines up with the very sort of topics which I talk about. And then it's non-personal in the fact that there are connections between it, which have absolutely nothing to do with me. So when you bring up baseball in that question, like, you know, I don't care about baseball. I have no idea who's won the World Series. I don't know like anything like that. But baseball as a concept and as a clue as to how this world works, and understanding what is holding things, what and how is holding things in linkage with one another, not necessarily bondage, but definitely a linkage. And then seeing how I float upon them naturally, like that to me is what's really important, is the demonstration and the telling of that.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, it is interesting, all of these threads and how they tie together. But yeah, thanks for clarifying. This is part one that you've released. So,
and I basically, in part one, I get down, like I demonstrate that connection, like the historical model, whether or not that happens or not, because we don't know anything that's happened before our experience. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just means maybe it did happen, maybe it didn't happen, or maybe there's another explanation entirely. Mm. But working with what we do know, so I establish that, and then I go in to this idea that the island has been linked to the concept of the underworld, like very, very clearly, like within paradigm, they're telling you this is the underworld, which then opens up the question of, well, what is the underworld? Why is this significant? And then why are you saying that this is the underworld? And real quickly, or the most obvious one, so I'll just say that, is, you know, the word Haiti. Haiti is phonetically the same. It's a French word, but it's phonetically the same as Hades. In fact, in Dominican Spanish, they'll drop the S. Like, that's just a known fact of how Dominican Spanish, the other part of Hispaniola, other than Haiti, they drop the S in their enunciation of most words that end with S. So they would call Hades Haiti anyway. Like, Haiti is the underworld. Mm. It's both the symbol of life and death. And so understanding that paradigm is held in place through esoteric ritual, and almost all of them are some type of life-death ritual. Like, that's the dance which they're trying to manage. Like, going to Haiti or going to this island and maybe recognizing its role esoterically, like for the listener, what it does is it begins to collapse some of the false narrative stories. And anytime they collapse, just like a subliminal advertisement, which you see the subliminal, you're like, oh, it no longer has its effect upon me because I've seen it. It collapses. The same is true when you see kind of how paradigm is held together in different types of esoteric ritual and types of geomancy. One last thing I want to just point about, like Hades, which is you know, built into the story that is experienced through paradigm, is Haiti quite literally the colony, I think it's called La Navidad, is the first colony from Europe in the New World. The first colony is right there. So the New World began on Haiti. And the New World is interchangeable now with what we call the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. All right? So when I say New World, I'm also saying the Western Hemisphere. Haiti as a country is, you know, it's always thrown throughout the news that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And now when you start thinking about, and Haiti is where all of it began, this whole idea of poorness and like the globalized banking system and like the world, like the organizations that define like whether a country is rich or poor, like they started the expansion there in their history. And now they're saying, not this is where it started and now it's poorest. And in many ways, it is the poorest, right? Like, you know, if you want to go and use those systems, and I would imagine anyone who spent time in Haiti, you know, you can see some of the poverty there. But the island Hispaniola, and particularly the Haiti side of it, is one of the most natural resource rich places on Earth. I mean, it's been deforested now, but there's a sense of irony that the poorest nation, which was the first colony, is also sitting on like the biggest treasure chest. And I think all of that is kind of, when understanding the mythology of the paradigm which we're living in, and you can see the mythology told through geopolitical sort of, you know, facts, you get an idea of all of the energies that are in play. So now let me even bring this back fuller circle. So when you become more aware of, like, there's just so much going on, like there's nothing to freak out about, and I suppose there's nothing to do, it's just becoming more aware of the nature of the realm, well, then you start to say, like, well, how do I want to interact with this? And so then that goes back to the question. It's like, you know, do I want to go and play the geocaching game where like where some like third party entity could be using my remote viewing capabilities for their own sort of purposes? Like, you know, this is part of what this experience is all about, is becoming aware, like everything is kind of set up that way. And so then as you become aware, and as you become more aware that you're part of it, when I say you, I just mean any individual, myself included, you know, what do I do, or what am I even doing? You know, that to me is a big part of this as well.
Well, and playing into the name game a bit, had you looked into the word Hispania at all?
I mean, I know it means little Spain, right? I guess that was Hispaniola. So what's Hispana? Hispania.
So Columbus, according to the official story, landed on Hispaniola and named it Insula Hispania, which is just means the island. And Hispania has a disputed meaning. So there's evidence to support that it is of Phoenician language, Punic origin during the colonization of Carthage, and it might be even further a derivative of a Hebrew word meaning the island of the hyrax. A hyrax is a type of herbivorous mammal, It would be inaccurate to say it's a rodent, but it looks like a rodent. It's actually closer related to elephants, believe it or not. But the Romans considered them just like rabbits. So in Latin, that might be like a way of saying rabbit. But it goes on to say that others derive the word from the Phoenician span, meaning hidden, and it may indicate hidden or remote or far distant land. So those latter meanings seem to track with my understanding of all this and my hypothesis that Atlantis was this great ancient civilization that was destroyed in a cataclysm, and then the refugees spread around the world, and some of them retained the knowledge and went back during the new age of discovery in the quote-unquote new world. And I, you know, it's not my sole hypothesis. Other people have surely come up with this, but I just, more and more, this tends to be a theme on my show, is that Columbus and these groups were actually acting or operating on foreknowledge of these lands from some sort of esoteric source. So maybe Hispania is an indication of that. And then, you know, the Phoenicians and their connections potentially to this world beyond the Atlantic Ocean, who knows? But yeah, just a little musings there, not really well thought out.
Well, actually, no, we're gonna run with that.
Cool.
Couple things is, I'm not endorsing any narrative of history, because I mean, you could find there are a million narratives in history, and this is a trickster world. This is I can't speak out of one side of my mouth and say and talk about the paradigm and the indoctrination and then the lying, and then use the very same sources to go and like justify any of the stories.
Yeah, true.
What I can say for certain is I can look at their stories, and what you just said lines up with level two of, once you start to like pull apart, once you start to pull apart the first level of the indoctrination and you start to asking who was Christopher Columbus and who were the Phoenicians and all of that. Well, that's how I would describe kind of what you articulated right there. Everything supports what you just said. And I want to hit this one thing in particular, because I think this is going to be new to you. And I think it's probably going to hit you in one of your sweet spots, because it's a lot of good topics that you find interesting. Okay.
Okay.
So Edgar Cayce, right? You know Edgar Cayce.
Of course.
And where, and do you know the name of the Edgar Cayce Association or organization?
Yeah, I get their newsletters, the ARE.
The ARE. And where is ARE headquarters? Do you know?
Yeah, it's in Virginia at the mouth of the Susquehanna River. I don't know the exact place name, but I know that because you told me that.
It's in Virginia Beach.
Right, Virginia Beach.
And Virginia Beach is actually, like, land-wise, it's enormous. It's very, very big for a variety of reasons, okay?
Okay.
So when you say it's in Virginia Beach, that could mean a whole, like, if we want to get down to yards, remember you said you can geo-guess into yards? If we want to get into yards, we want to go and narrow down, because Virginia Beach could mean a huge area. It is located probably 2 miles from the actual, like, there's a, on this, if you can imagine the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, and the Chesapeake Bay is the Susquehanna Bay, the southern or the bottom part of that mouth, there's like a, it's called a horn. It's like a bump if you're looking down two dimensionally. Right where that peak is, like the part of the land that goes deepest into the water right there, Edgar Cayce's association is headquartered 2 miles from that. So like very, very close. And the probably mile and three quarters, like from that exact moment to 1 mile and three quarters, that's all U.S. Army base anyway. So the ARE is located as close to that point as you can be without being on the naval or the army base. So I want to point that out. So I talked a little bit about that, imagining that energy going from the Susquehanna River. So the Susquehanna River begins in Cooperstown. It begins 500 feet away from the Baseball Hall of Fame itself. Goes all the way down the Susquehanna River. Then the Susquehanna River transitions in form and becomes an estuary. And an estuary is a blending of salt water and fresh water. And that is colloquially known as the Chesapeake Bay, but more accurately, it's the Susquehanna Bay, because it was the lower part of the river which flooded. This is what the geologists will tell you, that the lower valley of the Susquehanna River flooded 12,500 years ago when the Atlantic Ocean rose, and it created this estuary because the ocean level increased. So, you know, quick side note, that corresponds with a lot of the Atlantean mythology, is like it sunk in the Atlantic 12,500 years ago. But that's not where I'm going with this. Where I'm going with this is Edgar Cayce, who though is positioned as like a Presbyterian minister or Sunday school teacher, all of his trances were deeply sympathetic to theosophical perspective, or theosophical philosophy and theosophical history, though he claims never to have been involved or have read anything theosophical. Regardless, like what he talks about in his trances are very Atlantis-oriented. Much of our Atlantis understanding and myths come from the Theosophical Society, H.P. Blavatsky, and the Theosophical Press after her demise. So he sounds like a theosophist, but he doesn't claim to be a theosophist. And the theosophists are the ones who are behind the Baseball Hall of Fame. I didn't go into that, but that's what the next video is about.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break from this episode of Your Handbook for the Apocalypse / My Family Thinks I'm Crazy to thank our sponsors, our show sponsors for the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. That's right. First and foremost, the number one and only Hit Kit, the best way to get lit wherever you are, wherever you like to smoke. I hope it's outside. Get some fresh air in your lungs before you puff away on a joint, a spliff, a blunt, whatever it is. Wherever laws allow, we'll just say that. Get yourself a Hit Kit. It's a totally legal smoking paraphernalia device. It holds your lighter and whatever you're planning to smoke. It could just be tobacco, for all I know. But make sure you use the promo code CRAZY at checkout. CRAZY or CRAZY15. Try both of them. Sometimes I just say CRAZY. I think it might be CRAZY15 for one of these. But either way, it's CRAZY15 for Brain Supreme. But anyways, CRAZY, use promo code CRAZY and get a CRAZY discount of 15% off and get yourself a Hit Kit. Do it right, folks. Come on, I talk about it all the time. And my friend Garrett has amazing new designs and a super cool new stash box that's perfect if you like stickers and you need a place to put them. It's perfect. Same thing with some of these Hit Kits. But anyways, great stuff from the Hit Kit. We've got Brain Supreme, the number one way to microdose your way into a better way of life, possibly. You know, if that's something you're willing to explore, if you listened to my interview with Adam Schell and you liked what you heard, I definitely encourage you get in touch with Adam. He is a marvelous microdosing coach. He's helped over 2,500 clients, and you could be his next client. But it's really interesting stuff what they offer at BrainSupreme.co. This isn't your, you know, black market street value mushroom concoction that was probably poorly grown or, you know, who knows what. This is high quality stuff mixed with high quality nootropics and herbal supplementals to really boost the potential of whatever your goals are. I mean, really, the sky's the limit with BrainSupreme.co. You can accomplish so many things. I'll tell you right now, I microdosed a couple hours ago, And I think it made the rap intro that I did for this podcast all the better. I don't know. I think so. So take that as my endorsement for BrainSupreme.co and use Crazy15 at checkout to save. Of course, we've got Oregon.ite, the great Oregonite made in the great state of Oregon by my friend Isaac. Check out his custom Oregonite pyramids, all sorts of different designs, not just pyramids. There's all sorts of geometric designs. I don't know all the names of them, but apparently there's one on the way for me very soon that has a piece of cannabis infused into it. So who knows what kind of power that's going to unlock in my life. But if you want to do something cool like that with Oregonite, you can get in touch with Isaac and he will custom order really whatever you want. Again, sky's the limit with that. I have two really great Oregonite pieces. One of them is a crossover with the Hit Kit, and another one is this amazing, my family thinks I'm crazy, desk piece. It's like a yin yang symbol with Oregonite as the yin yang in the center. So great stuff from Oregon.ite on Instagram. Of course, Hit Kit on Instagram, or The Hit Kit on Instagram, hitkit.us, and then Brain Supreme also on Instagram. Go and check them all out. And we've got a new sponsor, that's Raw Optics. The link is in the description. If you're in the market for some blue blocking lenses, Raw Optics is the way to go. They've got two lenses, each designed for different times of day. So maybe you just want to ensure that before bed, you're going to get a restful sleep, even though you might need to check your phone or you're watching TV or whatever your nightly routine may be. These blue blocking lenses are going to help your body and your mind wind down. And I definitely need it because I am up way too late producing this podcast. So anyways, enough about that. And let's get back to the show with Mike Wan after a quick break to our dynamic ads. And remember, if you want every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast ad-free, even your Handbook for the Apocalypse crossovers like this one, sign up on the Patreon or the Substack and you get every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast, plus bonus episodes and more, ad-free and interruption-free. So thank you for listening, and we'll be right back after this quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So let's go back to Edgar Cayce. He made many predictions in his trances, and his trances are very well scribed, and they've been, you know, you could sort them and you could read them all. And one of his predictions, which he made as it relates to Atlantis, he said that, well, two things. He talked about this fabled blue stone in Atlantis. He talked about two blue stones. So he's talked about a fabled blue stone of Atlantis, which led to its demise. But then on a separate and a different prediction, he said that there will be discovered in the future in the Caribbean Sea a rare blue stone found nowhere else on Earth. And this blue stone is a remnant of Atlantis. Okay, so Edgar Cayce, he made the prediction of the blue stone. This probably happened in the 1930s. 1974, on the island of Hispaniola, a mine was discovered. And that mine produced a rare form of sea blue pectolite, which goes under the trade name of Larimar. And Larimar is only found in one place in the world, and it's in this mine. It's the only place it's found. And this mine, it was discovered in 1974. Obviously, the stone had been seen, like pieces of it wash up on the shore, but no one knew where it came from. It wasn't, and it can't be mined when it just washes up on the floor, on the seafloor. When they discovered this mine in 1974, many followers of Edgar Cayce concluded that this was the fulfillment of his prediction of the blue stone, which is found nowhere else on Earth and will be found in the Caribbean Sea. And, you know, it's found on that same island, the same island as Christopher Columbus and the Phoenicians, you know. The word Hades, as the concept of the underworld, that's Greek. In the story they tell us in terms of the linear unfoldment of civilization, it began, you know, in Sumer and then goes more or less to Greece and Rome and then Europe, and then it came east. So Greece, you know, Greece has a huge impact in the shaping of the indoctrination of civilization. And Hades is a Greek word and a Greek concept. And Atlantis was introduced into the collective consciousness through one of Greece's most favorite philosophers, that of Plato. So there's just like, when you begin to look like to the point which you're just making, there's just so many of these connections, which, you know, certainly seem to be immensely complementary.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking into a little bit more about Larimar now, and it's a silicate composite of calcium and sodium, and the blue color comes from copper being substituted for calcium. I don't know what that means on a mineralogical basis. I think copper would, on a molecular level, substitute the calcium at some point somehow, but I don't know how that works. But yeah, fascinating stuff. And you're absolutely right, it's only been found in this one part of the Dominican Republic in the Bajo Ruco mountain range.
That's where I stayed.
And the natives believe the stone came from the sea. They also called the gem blue stone. Very creative.
So this is funny. Barahona is where the mine is, and I stayed in Barahona for part of the trip. And on a shoestring budget done through Airbnb, and we got to a couple places, and they did not, the place was unacceptable. It didn't match like the Airbnb description. And so we kind of moved around. And eventually, like we had a scramble while we were there to find places to stay. And we found one place on Airbnb that just sounded perfect. And it was a coffee farm, and it was up in the mountains, and the price was right. And so we're like, oh, and it's quiet. Like part of it was like just getting it away from all of the noise. It's very loud. So in the city of Barahona and the town surrounding it. So we ended up staying there for three of the nights. And it is a farm. In order to get to it, you have to take an 8-mile drive up a dirt road. And it was like, it's a mountainous road. So it's really steep and like the certainly questions on whether or not the rental car can make it up there. But one, it turns out, I didn't realize this until I got home, so that farm is about a mile away from where the mine is in the mountains. Like, so it's on the same mountain. So that was kind of funny. But where I'm going with this story and where it gets like, where it just makes me laugh. So the Airbnb guy, wasn't local. He was American. He was in New Mexico when I booked it. but we were communicating over like an Airbnb platform or over WhatsApp or something. So his profession, like what he did as a, you know, as a career, he managed the desk for USAID in Haiti. He was the deputy director. He was the deputy director of the desk for USAID in Haiti.
Oh, wow.
So do you know what USAID is?
From our initial conversation off the air, I remember a little bit, but please fill our audience in.
So USAID is, I think it's quasi-government, like public-private. It might be all government agency, and it's who the United States government sends for humanitarian crises, like, you know, there's an earthquake or if there's a like impoverished areas. I think USAID has like a $50 billion annual budget, to give you an idea of like the size of it. And it was started in the 60s, I think, under JFK. But USAID has, since its beginning, been connected with the CIA. And the idea is it, under the guise of humanitarian crises, is like it gets people in country. So that's why it would be a good fit for a clandestine operation. And if you go and you look, there's just like lots of stories which connect, you know, whether or not it's factual. That doesn't necessarily mean that everyone who works at USAID is CIA, but what it does, there is an overlap. And I mean, I think the most recent thing I saw, just doing a little bit of searching, like a year or two ago, there was like an execution of an American citizen in Iran, and he was accused of being a spy, and he was there underneath the umbrella of USAID. Again, that's not to say if this guy was guilty or not guilty of being a spy. I'm just saying that there is a strong correlation. And so there's a strong correlation, like pretty much like who's going to go and be aware of it? Like usually what I would assume what would happen, assuming that it's not a 100% intelligence operation, if it's just like perhaps a cover, which is used occasionally, you're probably going to have a certain level of understanding within the administration of that organization, so that when someone comes in, maybe it, like the people are aware that so-and-so might have, should be treated differently, let's say. And who would know that? Particularly in a place like Haiti, which has a very, very strong history with the CIA, would be the desk chief. So I'm not saying he's involved, that he's involved with the CIA, but there certainly could be made a considerable argument, and like the odds aren't necessarily outrageous.
Right.
So then said another way, I'm staying in this like CIA farm in the middle of Hispaniola, 100 miles from the Haitian border. Had an amazing time. Guy who I spoke to, fantastic. Like, you know, I'm not making any claims. I'm just saying, like, this is fitting like my narrative. Like, I'm laughing at the absurdity that this is where we are. And then there was this place where they kept their dogs. There were three dogs that were on the farm. And like two of them, I guess, they kept locked away from everyone else. And it was this probably like 12 foot by 12 foot by 12 foot cinder block cube with a cinder block ceiling and like one door and one window. I'm like, if there's going to be a place where they're going to lock people up, that's exactly where they're going to put it.
Jeez, yeah.
And so I bring that up because like this idea of, you know, whether it was Dale Graff's place when I was in Hamburg and Project Stargate, or some of the other strange things, there seems to be in at least my travels, and we've talked about this before, Mark, like, you know, what are these intelligence agencies? Are they not, are they much more than, you know, the way they've been presented and the way we've been indoctrinated to understand them? There's an implied connection almost everywhere I go, which overlaps with said agencies.
Yeah, it's more often than not. There's a sort of observer-created experience, if you will. But, you know, what you put stock in, you get back, right?
So right. To speak. Well, 100%. That's how this realm works with consciousness. Like, whatever you're feeding, like, you're going to, like, create a feedback loop with.
Right.
You could be connected to things all the time, which have a feedback loop into you, and you don't even realize what they're creating with you. That's the mystery, and that's the, you know, the need for awareness in terms of understanding how this realm works. And that's not a bad thing. It's like, that's just how it works.
Right. Well, and I don't want to jump around too much. I'm not sure how much of a departure we've gone from your original idea of what you were going to talk about, but I'm kind of curious about these underworld aspects of Hispaniola and if you noticed any of that. I know you didn't visit Haiti. You were close to it. You told me off the record here that you were close to the border, but, you know, Haiti has a reputation for not only, well, I guess, yeah, the underworld, everything from voodoo to zombies, resurrected corpses, and, you know, all kinds of strange mystical type stuff. Does the Dominican Republic, or the places that you went to within the Dominican Republic, is there like a bleed over of that culture, or do, is it kind of like considered, you know, below them? Like, cause I do know from what I've researched that there's kind of like an interesting social dynamic where, you know, the Dominican Republic or the Dominicans feel maybe like they're more better off, which isn't far from the truth, than the Haitians. They kind of see them as like nuisance, so to speak, or like lesser thans.
So, all right. That's a big question. First off, when I was at the farm, I was there for 3 nights, and I didn't leave the farm. Like, getting up there was so tough on the car. We're like, all right, we're going to do it as infrequently as possible. So we're just going to do it once. We drove up there, kept the car there, and really just stayed on the grounds for 3 days. And it was fantastic. It was one of the best parts of the trip. And there wasn't any Wi-Fi or internet access where we were staying, but maybe about a half mile down the dirt road, and this is a road which is managed and owned by a mining company, there was a Haitian shantytown. It was a Haitian shantytown. You know, the first question I wondered to myself is like, how did this town come into existence? And why is there a Haitian shanty town half a mile away from the former director of the Haitian desk for USAID? But my point is, I would go there like once a day if I had to check in, like, you know, with people back in the United States. That's where I would have Wi-Fi access. And so I would like sit in the Haitian shanty town where there was kind of like what looked like a bus stop, though no bus could get up there. And that's where I would sit and do my thing when I had to check in. And I was sitting with all the other Haitians who were on their phones. So I definitely had a little bit of Haitian interaction.
Well, and I should say I grew up with a good friend of mine growing up who's from Haiti. His parents were beautiful, wonderful, kind people who were always super welcoming, always invited me over to dinner if I was having, you know, if I was hanging out playing basketball or whatever with their son. So I didn't mean to, you know, disparage Haitians or presuppose your view of them. I think they're beautiful people, but there's
I was just indicating, that I had a little bit more connection than just being like near Haiti.
Cool. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So in the video, which I made, which I just put out, I go deeper into the, underworld talk. And in the baseball one, which I'm making right now, I go into voodoo, which is a Haitian religion. There's Haitian voodoo, there's Louisiana voodoo, there's Santeria from Cuba, and they're all very significant within the cultures there. Like, I'm by no means an expert, but that certainly, that tied in a very strange way as well, or like a personal way as well. There's a, within the, I guess I would call it the pantheon of voodoo saints or gods or spirits, probably the one who is best known, his name is Baron Samdi. And if you'd see him, you'd recognize his image right away. Always wearing top hat, maybe a long-tailed coat like a tuxedo. And
has his face painted like a skeleton almost.
Yeah, he's always dressed like a skeleton, has a cane.
Yeah, I have have seen this when, you know, voodoo has come up in my research. Yeah, I have seen this image.
You see it in Mardi Gras. It's like, it's kind of like the stock image or the standard, like voodoo for the most part has a really negative misconception, I think, in the mainstream mind. You know, it freaks people out, you know, and its practices, like, I understand why that meets the American mainstream mind and why they would be freaked out by it. But that's probably not an accurate way in terms of how it's received locally there. Mm. But anyway, so Baron Samdi is the most recognized of all of the in the pantheon within voodoo. He's the keeper of the underworld. You know, Hades is both a name and a person in, and it is like, we could, if we want to intellectualize it, it's the personification of what the underworld represents. And so Baron Samdi is the same thing. He is the personification, if you will, of what the underworld represents. And that is what's best known from Haiti. And Haiti is called Hades. You know, you begin to go and see this sort of underworld sort of continuity written into like the collective mind. And then you ask yourself, well, what is the underworld? The underworld, it's typically thought of as like, this is where things go to die. That's not what the underworld is. It's the underworld is where things that have died go to, you know, be recycled into what comes next. Not necessarily saying in reincarnation, but within the realm which we live, like, everything dies and then it's comes back, you know, whether that's a tree that dies in winter and then comes back in the spring, or whether it's the use of like cow manure for fertilizer, like, that's the nature and that mystery of when things are dead and they come back alive. Like, that's the underworld in the mythologies, like, you know, in astrology, Pluto, who's, you know, the keeper of the underworld, very similar to Hades, like, death and sex. That's what Pluto's about. Baron Samdi, death and sex. So there's always this sex sort of relationship with the underworld's about. It's like, it's all of the gooey mystery of life on this realm. And so the underworld is often intimidating to people for a variety of reasons, primarily just like they're both drawn to, all humans, I think, are drawn to it and scared of it and like all this stuff. And part of that might just be cultural, because of how we've been taught to deal with sex. And the richest potentiality, you know, it's where everything originates. So the lord of the underworld, to have a land which is tied to the underworld, is much more than just saying that it's a place that's tied to death.
Right. You broke up just a couple times there. I don't, hopefully the recording still got you, but I missed just one part of what you said about how, after you said the part about Hades being, you know, a figure, a name, a place, having these multiple meanings, you were kind of cutting out there.
I apologize. I was actually just walking around the room I'm in. I won't do that again. So it was, well, we'll just keep going with the conversation. I don't remember what I said, and hopefully the recording kept it. If not, not meant to be.
It's all good. Yeah, and I do sort of, it is kind of funny. I have noticed that about voodoo. It is sensationalized when it's not all that dissimilar from any other culture's version of mysticism or magic. You know, it's just been taken by Hollywood and used as this prop, particularly in like the early days of film. You'd have a lot of kind of the plot would center around like a voodoo doll or a curse or something like that. But tons of interesting stuff to think about. And as you pointed out, this is only part one. You've got part two coming
right
out
now. I want to, before we move off of that, we've talked about baseball a little bit in the beginning and being a fan. Have you ever heard of something which was called the curse of the Chicago Cubs?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And didn't have something to do with somebody bringing like a goat to the stadium.
Totally. It came from this thing which was called the Billy Goat Curse. And part of like when you get deep into like the history, mystery of theosophy and baseball, one of the things which you see that this one guy shows up over and over again. His name is Albert Spalding. He's the guy who's behind the Spalding Sporting Goods Company. He used to own was a partial owner of the Chicago White Stockings. And the Chicago White Stockings was the name before they became the Chicago Cubs. So the proto Chicago Cubs. This guy, Albert Spalding, was a prominent theosophist. And he claimed, or he was an owner of one of the baseball teams and was the head of a commission. And based upon his commission, they came to the conclusion that some dude invented baseball at Cooperstown. And Spalding's the guy who's behind that. Spalding's the theosophist. And the guy who they say invented it was the former president of the Theosophical Society. Okay?
Right.
So not only that, so now we're beginning to see this thing with theosophy. Within theosophy and within Hinduism and a lot of other religions and within mathematics, the number 108 is considered sacred. And so there's 108 stitches on the baseball. And that's really big to theosophy, 108. Albert Spalding's company, the Spalding Sporting Good, is the company that makes all the baseballs. They made the first baseball, and they've been the only baseball manufacturer until like the 1980s. Now, I think there might be a variety of official of makers of baseball. So we got Spalding again. So this curse, which you're talking about, it happened with Chicago Cubs, Spalding's team, and it had to do with a goat. And it eventually came to an end. And what the curse was that the Chicago Cubs would never win a World Series. And then a handful of years ago, they won the World Series, and for the first time in a long time, and everyone said the curse has been broken. And so you know how long it was that Chicago curse, Chicago Cubs curse of not winning a World Series was?
Wild guess, 108 years.
Exactly, 108 years.
Whoa.
But now let's bring it all back to center, or back to the beginning. It was the Billy Goat Curse, and like one of the things which people used to do, Cub fans, we talked about being fans. Cub fans are known for being immensely loyal and immensely committed, and they love the curse and all this sort of stuff. And they would bring goats to the stadium. Maybe not inside the stadium, but outside the stadium, and kind of make like spectacles of them. Goat sacrifice is a really, really key significant thing within the practice of voodoo.
Were any goats killed in the making of the...
It's all just woven. It's all woven together. Just go search, like, in front of the computer. Goat sacrifice voodoo. And you're going to see, like, you know, it's... And that's part of what the practice is. This is one of the reasons why I think like, you know, voodoo is misconstrued or like really thought of as so strange to the mainstream mind is because the idea of animal sacrifice just seems so barbaric. It's what kosher meat is, ritually sacrificed animals. You know, it's silly to think that ritual sacrifice is not throughout our world right now. The Hebrew national hot dogs sold in all of the baseball stadiums.
That's all sacrificial meat. Wow. I never even thought of it like that. And it's, geez, Mike, you really pull back that shiny veneer on American culture and reveal a dusty underbelly that is just brimming with cult, esoteric, all kinds of stuff. Wow. So
let me, I just want to clarify that image which you just created. It's not a dusty underbelly. It's like it's the underworld. It's a moist and gooey and maybe like foul, maybe not foul in terms of a judgmental sense, but yeah, like there is what's going on. Everything which is going on, we'll go this back to the geocaching or the geochasing or guessing game, whatever it was. It's like, everything we're involved with, whether it's technology or not technology, something as innocent as going to a baseball game, winning participants in something much, 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 much deeper than what you're probably aware of.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. The great revealing, the apocalypse as it was. Thanks, Mike.
Well, you know what, Mark, we should probably, I don't think that we covered a lot of the things which I wanted to cover, and particularly what would be the more like maybe more theoretical, more experiential theories of the experiences which I had, like talk about some of that in future episodes. And so perhaps we'll just continue to share those on the podcast itself so that I don't, on the Handbook for the Apocalypse podcast itself, and that way we'll bring some new life into it. Now that went to the underworld, it's ready to come back to life.
Yeah, I love it. This is a great way to reemerge from that dormant period. And yeah, if you're able to do more Your Handbook for the Apocalypses, I would love to. I think our format of doing it over the phone might even see an improvement in the way that I record it, and we might have some better clarity there. So, but yeah, awesome stuff. And if you're able to, I'd love to do that in-person podcast soon.
Yeah, hopefully let's shoot to do that.
Cool. Well, I know we got to wrap up now, but folks, we're going to put a pin in this and come back to this topic in this conversation, because Mike has only just released part one of what might be a 4 or 5 part series breaking down all of the very interesting threads that we just sort of began to unravel today. Really only just the first few millimeters of thread there, and there's so much more to unspool. So with that, Mike, you're always welcome here on this show, but I agree with you. I think it is a smart move to continue this conversation on Your Handbook for the Apocalypse. So I encourage everybody listening to do that now. Go and type in Susquehanna Alchemy wherever you listen to this podcast, and you will find Mike's podcast feed. It is just like his YouTube channel titled Susquehanna Alchemy. And while you're at it, if you're not already following him on YouTube, go and do so at Susquehanna Alchemy. That's Susquehanna. Is there an extra H at the end? No, maybe just in the Celtic way of spelling it. But either way, Susquehanna Alchemy is the place for all this stuff and more on Instagram, on YouTube. And Mike, if you will, as we sort of wind down and wrap up here, tell the folks about your Starboard sessions and anything else you want to let them know about.
Definitely. I appreciate that, the offer or the opportunity to do so.
Yeah.
If you want to have like a personal experience working with the energetic posture, which I hold, the philosophy which I bring, which is ultimately like ways of of like embodying freedom, like out, like I was talking about in consciousness in the very beginning, outside of paradigm and outside of sense of ego. My starboard sessions or my starboard ceremonies are the way to do that. And that's when I take my own approach to the heavens. I wouldn't call myself an astrologer, more of an unastrologer, because I poke holes in like the astrology prison, which most of the interpretations do to an individual. And but there's something of great significance of understanding your individuality through the movement of the heavens. Like there's something still true in astrology and valuable, but just if not handled appropriately, it can be very, very limited. If you want that peace, you can get in touch with me. And either if you live in the Northeast of the United States, you could come to the farm I stay at and have it done in person. Or for what the majority of people have is I record a session on the starboard where I build your chart. I ceremony and ritualistically integrate it with the chart of the moment. I explain how all of this is done. It's not like mumbo jumbo. It makes total perfect sense. And you are able to follow along intellectually, but also experience it energetically, emotionally. And it is a symbol of moving outside of the paradigm timelines, which you know, you've more or less been born into, and to help gravitate what it takes in order to finally become, start becoming free to, and that all begins in consciousness. So if that's something you're interested in, the only way you're going to find out about it, because I don't have a website, there's no way to do it through Linktree, is you have to email me directly. So Mark, if you could include my email address in the liner notes, or I guess if you're just listening, it's mkwan@comcast.net, but that's the way, that's the only way you can order it.
Awesome. Awesome stuff, Mike. I will definitely include that. And I look forward to continuing our conversation. I'm sort of still like rubbing the crust out of my eyes here. So excuse my foggy head, but yeah, it's been a while. I'm glad to be back in the swing of things with you, Mike. It's a little bit of a learning curve to get back into the swing of it. But yeah, anyways, awesome stuff. Really happy to talk to you again. And for the folks tuning in, we'll catch you on the next episode of Your Handbook for the Apocalypse with more. Until next time, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are at the end of our Your Handbook for the Apocalypse, My Family Thinks I'm Crazy crossover episode. And if you weren't aware, Mike Wan and I do a podcast together. It's called Susquehanna Alchemy. That's the name of the feed that you can find it on. We call the show Your Handbook for the Apocalypse, but there's more than just that show on the feed. There's other stuff there too. The show that Mike and Ross Ben did together, and I hope they still do it. I mean, I hope they put out more episodes in the future. But From the 40th Parallel is also on there. So it's a great archive if you're a fan of myself, but also Ross Ben and Mike Wan, who have a really brilliant catalog of information in this RSS feed. So it's not just the show here with Mike Wan. It's more than that. And you can find it by just typing in Susquehanna Alchemy, Susquehanna Alchemy. But I already spelled that in the interview, and I don't want to be too repetitive. But anyways, here we are, just chilling in the outro. And I encourage everybody to sign up on the Patreon or the Substack. This episode was a little too short for some of it to be for the Patreon only, but I definitely want to fill you guys in on some big news. I'm going to save it for the Patreon Substack episode outro, for the outro for this one. Because even though there's no extension to this episode, I'm still going to put out an ad-free version of the show on the Patreon or the Substack. So still, consider signing up. It's only $5 a month on the Patreon or $8 on the Substack. And you might as well just sign up at the $8 tier
on the Patreon if you're interested in the Substack, because if you message me and remind me, I will give you a free subscription to the Substack. Recently, my man Kent Woods got on the Substack. He loves it. Shout out to Kent. And yeah, we got a ton of people on the Substack instead of the Patreon because they prefer Substack. But either way, whatever you choose, go for it. And thank you for supporting the show, all those who do, to all those who sent me a Venmo to help fund the little filming outing. It was a success. I filmed some really cool stuff, and the video will be up within the next week or so. It'll go out on the Patreon and the Substack first, and then eventually onto YouTube. So do check that out, and everybody who gave me a donation for that will receive credit in the video itself. And if you would like to support the show with a one-time donation, at Mystic Mark on Venmo is the best place to do it. But you can also hit me at PayPal, Alt Media United, or PayPal at Mystic Mark. It's the same as Venmo, Mystic Mark on PayPal as well. And I just prefer Venmo because there's less fees involved with transferring the money out of PayPal, or I'm sorry, with Venmo rather than PayPal. So anyways, yeah, and if you're really forward technically, then you can send me some crypto, and you just have to send me a message and I will let you know my pass key and whatnot. It's actually in the episode description if you want to send me Bitcoin, but you can also send me other stuff too. I just have to send you the right wallet address. So anyways, enough about that, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. I don't know if I sound different or better, but I am temporarily using a Rodecaster Pro 2 to record the podcast. I don't know how long I'll be able to use this to record the podcast. I'll probably have to go back to using the Rodecaster Pro, which is safe and sound behind me. But this Rodecaster Pro 2 is amazing, and I love using it. It's a real privilege. So I hope you notice a difference in the way I sound. Maybe I sound more like my own voice. I don't know. I haven't really played around with the settings because the settings are very good. But I definitely think that I don't have the same effects on that I did on my last Rodecaster, which this isn't my Rodecaster. I'm using it temporarily. We'll see how long I'm able to use it. But anyways, enough about that. Sign up on the Patreon or the Substack to hear more about all this great stuff, and look forward to more episodes with myself and Mike Wan on Your Handbook for the Apocalypse. Go and sign up there. Support our friend Mike Wan on YouTube at Susquehanna Alchemy. Go and check out his full video, multiple videos about this topic that we discussed today. And until next time, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.